Welcome back to another Film Weekly with me, Jason Solomons. This week, for your further listening pleasure, we have a living legend of French cinema. Isabelle Huppert talks to Andrew Pulver about her latest starring role in the surreal Belgian comedy Home. And I meet up with a new directorial talent, Cary Fukunaga, whose film Sin Nombre tells of an escape from the gangland violence of Mexico. Helping me to review some of this week's releases is Catherine Short, editor of the Guardian Film website. We'll be reviewing the re-release of a French masterpiece, Les Demoiselles de Rochefort. Yes, it's as rare and welcome as a sunny day in a British summer. It's Film Weekly. This week sees the UK release of the feature debut of Cary Fukunaga. His film Sin Nombre tells the story of a young Honduran girl, Syra, on a hazardous train journey through Central America and Mexico in the hope of crossing illegally into the US. On her way, and in violent circumstances, she meets Casper, a teenage member of the vicious Mala Salvatrucha gang, and for very different reasons, Casper must now join her in a desperate attempt to make it across the border.
¿Eh? Vamos a tener que bajar.
¿Por qué?
En esta estación siempre anda cagando el palo la migra. Y a veces también locuras.
And I'm delighted to say that we have director Cary Fukunaga in the studio with us here at Film Weekly. Welcome to Film Weekly, Cary.
Thank you for having me.
Am I pronouncing it right? Is it Cary or Cary? Is it Cary as in Cary Grant?
Exactly, yeah.
Exactly as in Cary Grant?
Well, my last name's not correct.
No, exactly. But you have the Cary Grant glasses. You look good. Were you named after Cary Grant?
My mom was a pretty big fan, yeah.
Wow. Yeah, so you had to go into movies, quite clearly.
It was basically set from birth what my job would be.
Yeah, well, congratulations, because your feature debut won a directing award and a cinematography award at Sundance last January, and your film Sin Nombre was at the Edinburgh Festival, and finally it's arrived on our screens here across the UK this weekend. So congratulations on that. It's a film about a journey. It must have been a hell of a journey making this film as well.
Yeah, it's been about 5 years now. Lots of research journeys and traveling with immigrants as well as just the journey of getting it made and the production and post-production and now traveling with it across the country in the United States and then now in Europe.
Right. And I mean, how the interesting part of the film, I suppose, is this massive humanity that you picture. There's some extremely haunting shots of people sleeping at stations or on railway tracks, the risk of life they have in order to travel in hope for a better life. Is that what really got you? Is that what the point of the whole project was, if you're going to spend 5 years of your life doing it?
I think some of the images that grabbed me initially were the images of people riding on top of those trains and the bandits and sort of facing the environment. It was something I never even imagined could take place, and yet it was taking place very close to our own borders. I grew up with immigration as a topic. I grew up in California, and I never really considered it something that I would make a film about. But I made a short film called Victoria Paracino, which did treat the subject. And in doing research for that short film, I learned about the trains.
Right. And this is what this is about. This is the people who just want to work, really, who will risk their lives to sit on top of a train, a hazardous journey that could involve the heads being chopped off by branches, being attacked by gangs, yeah. Starvation, everything. That's the kind of everyday reality for these people, isn't it?
It's quite a brutal journey. I think it's really difficult for people to understand why someone would go through such a thing to work what you consider to be menial labor in the United States and even in the UK. But you start to get a clearer picture when you meet their families. You understand that the need to feed a child and what that survival mechanism that kicks in that you need to take care of your own. They'll go through anything to do that.
And you actually sort of did some of this journey as well in your search for veracity as a filmmaker. You went and rode on top of a train illegally.
Yeah, I rode a couple of trains.
Yeah.
Yeah, with immigrants. Basically, the train segments that are in the film are about what I did, and that's kind of why the train disappears about halfway through the journey, because I didn't do the last part.
Because that takes you across the border, and you'd probably be... But you had a passport, you'd probably have been all right.
Yeah, I still got pulled off the train by Mexican immigration.
Right.
And was arrested for about a day.
So tell me about sitting on top of those trains, because it is, as you say, it's a strong image. It's out on the poster of your train, the beautiful image of the people hunched across the... I mean, it is a sort of an image that disappeared years ago when we used to see films in westerns, everyone having a fight on top of a train, but that has sort of disappeared, apart from documentaries like Wild Star when they were graffitiing on top of the trains in Brooklyn, the metro trains. This is a rather different kind of journey.
Yeah, the stories about what would happen on top of those trains are were all over the newspapers in Mexico, and going down there personally and meeting people who had been attacked, for example, on the trains, you'd hear endless stories. It does feel like the Old West. You start talking to people, and even the imagery of the train and the bandits and the tattooing of the gang members and the corrupt police, all these things feel like they're straight out of the Old West with a little bit of Mad Max.
Yeah, absolutely. Because these trains are big impersonal monsters. They're like, you know, leviathans that have no personality. They just keep going. And is there anyone on these trains? What are these trains? They're big kind of corrugated monsters. Scary things.
Well, there's definitely a conductor on the train. And the first train I got on, actually, the train stopped. They're not passenger trains. They're cargo trains.
Right.
And it actually stopped. We picked up about 200 immigrants that are waiting on the side of the road. And then the train backed up, and you could see the conductor being paid off.
Right, by the traffickers, the gang members, right. who kind of organized
not the gang members, but the actual smugglers themselves.
Right. Because there's so many layers at play in your film. There's the gang members who the tattooed kind of violence, and I don't know what they really do. And I suppose they drug traffic, they kind of people traffic as well. Then there's the people who do the people trafficking, and there's all this kind of hierarchy going on.
Right, the gang does it smartly. They use less manpower. They basically tax.
Right.
So it's racketeering, and they don't have to do the movement of the immigrants, although they do have to control the territory every now and then.
I think there's an interesting development at the moment. I noticed that your executive producers were the other wonderful Mexican actors, Diego Luna and Gael Garcia Bernal, whose film Rudo and Corsi we had recently released here. Tell me about your involvement with them, how they got involved, and why you approached them, and how they helped.
Amy Kaufman, the producer of the film, and I approached them because we wanted the film to be a Mexican film from the very beginning. And she'd worked with them from the studio side, on Y Tu Mama Tambien and other projects.
She did Motorcycle Diaries as well, didn't she?
Yeah, she was a VP over at Focus at that time, and then she went independent and still had a very close relationship with Focus. So their company, Canana, also worked with Focus, and it was sort of like an immediate meeting. Once we decided we wanted to do this in Mexico, and Focus decided they wanted to make the film. And they sort of became godfathers of the project and, I think, legitimatize it.
Yeah, they are quite socially conscious. They want to portray their country in a realistic light.
Right, yeah, they're definitely down for doing projects that are not mainstream Mexican pop films.
So. Mm-hmm. And they didn't want to be in this.
No,
which is
fine because they're great actors, but I think we lose a bit of authenticity.
Yeah, there's only two big stars sitting on top of a train. I don't believe you. It was hard in Rudo and Corsi to believe them as banana plantation people. You know, that handsome, and it was a funny film. Tell me also about your cinematographer, a very interesting cinematographer who won the award at Sundance, because, I mean, there's some just absolutely gorgeous, lush shots here, which I think some people, I must admit, I found a little bit sort of, I thought it was beautiful, and I thought, well, actually, the subject's so tough as well, but you've got this beautiful cinematography kind of contrasting with this very tough kind of story.
Yeah, I don't know how you would compose to do an ugly shot at the same time. I think some of the vistas there are just naturally beautiful, and we're seeing different parts of Mexico, which is also a beautiful country. The trains happen to go through wilderness areas and, you know, jungle and whatnot, and just sort of the farmland, so you get to see these really pastoral views. In terms of the treatment of the image, I think Adriano Goldman, he comes more from the school of Fernando Marea, so he was working with O2, and, you know, he did a City of Men, which was the television show
that went after
City of God. So he definitely had that other aesthetic down, but that wasn't what we were going for. And I think he was happy to do something that wasn't continuing that style. And I think we're doing something that was a bit older, more like from the 70s, like Cassavetes, or if we could try something more like Days of Heaven,
right?
And just take our time and longer lingering shots and. Just like the train, you know, it has a slow.
Yeah, you don't have the same frenetic cutting energy as well that Moraes brought to British City of God. Kerry, the film's done very well for you, obviously. It's going to act as a great calling card. Has something happened since Sundance, since your success with the release of St. Nombre? Has something happened to you career-wise that we should know about?
Well, I think the relationship with Focus has sort of been solidified, and I'm writing a new script for them right now. Which is going to be a complete genre shift, actually. And
it's a musical.
It's a musical.
You see?
Yeah.
Fantastic. Is it really?
Yeah.
That was a guess. You look like a musical guy.
Well, we were just talking about Remy just before. So, James Shamus is I think he's pretty excited to do a musical of Focus. And it'll be an original. So this is not based on any kind of Broadway musical or film.
Right. Originally, you write music as well?
Not really. I play around, but I'm going to work with a very talented composer.
And fantastic.
I'm in talks with a very.
I look forward to that. I don't know what realistic kind of pursuits you can do to kind of get the realism of a musical, like some train ride or tap dancing ferociously through the gangland.
There won't be much dancing in this musical. I'll tell you that much.
Well, if you do dancing, let us know. We're going to come on set and we're going to see how you're getting on with that musical. I'd love a musical. If it's as good as Les Demoiselles de Rochefort, then congratulations. And if it's as good as Sin Nombre as well, shouldn't be too half bad. So, Kerry Fukunaga, thank you very much for joining us on Film Weekly. Congratulations on your debut film, Sin Nombre.
Thank you very much.
Joining me now to review some of this week's other releases, including Sin Nombre, is Catherine Shaw, editor of the best film site on the web, guardian.co.uk/film. Lovely to see you, Catherine. How are you?
I'm all right. Thank you, Jason. How are you?
Yeah, I'm very well. This week, look, we'll be reviewing Mid-August Lunch, which is Pranzo di Ferragosto in Italian. Then we'll do Les Demoiselles de Rochefort, or The Young Ladies of Rochefort. And then we'll do Sin Nombre, or Without a Name. All the films are foreign this week, but that's good because in the summer the blockbusters dominate, but the little films get a chance, I think, which is nice. Sin Nombre, we heard from the director Cary Fukunaga just before. How did you think his debut went?
There was a lot of publicity about how he'd ridden cargo trains as research and all that. And you know, you sort of initially you think, oh, well, that's good. And then you sort of think, well, I should hope so, because, I mean, it's not that taxing. You're writing a film about it, probably good to give it a go. But in fact, it's not. I didn't find it.
Do you think so? I mean, do you think? I don't know. Do you think that that Ernst Lehmann sat in a field and had a crop duster plane come at him when
so.
He was writing North by Northwest?
I hope so. Anyway,
do you think that? Do you think it's necessary? I mean, it depends if you know the film or not, doesn't it? If you get the advanced publicity, I didn't know the film really at all. It sort of crept up on me. Sin announcement.
No, I don't know if it matters. I think it sort of matters in a way because I think the film is tries to be gritty and isn't,
yes.
And it's all sort of filtered actually through a very Hollywood sensibility. It's very gorgeous and honeyed, and it sort of detracts from it. And also, it's trying to be super gritty. It's trying to up the ante. And so, you know, while you all have seen in City of God or whatever, a little kiddie shooting somebody, now you get to see a little kiddie shooting somebody, and then dogs eating the body. You know, and it tries to do that, but it kind of it didn't ring true for me.
Yes, it's interesting because it was shot by Adriana Goldman, who is a cinematographer, not of City of God, but of City of Men, the sequel sort of to City of God. And it has that look. And I did feel, well, I used to love this kind of stuff, I thought. But
you were a boy then.
I was a younger man, I think, maybe. And I mean, I loved City of God. I mean, but its freshness was what took you. And I just thought this was kind of going over that ground again.
It was. And the way in which the sort of the baddie is the man, crazy, tattooed, scary face man. And the goodie has a little tattoo of a teardrop, you know. Little bit cheesy for me.
And also the girl who is the sort of star of it, the girl who is kind of coming from Honduras. I'd seen her before in a very strange film called Trade, in which she was also being traded across the border, but this time by Kevin Kline.
Right.
So, I mean, I think it's great that this kind of, you know, mass exodus of immigration is being drawn to our attention. However, every film that stars a sort of Mexican or a Honduran sort of actress, they get to do this. I mean, Hollywood sort of says, brilliant, you look like an Indian American, fantastic, you can be used as human traffic, that's fantastic. We'll usually Maria Full of Grace had the same kind of thing, an American making a film about that kind of
And yet
area.
That was sort of better. That was more, you know, that was detailed and interesting and sort of, it did feel realistic. I mean, I don't know. I've never been trafficked or emigrated to anywhere. So maybe it's just like that, but I certainly didn't seem so.
Right. Well, let's whisk you off in this case to another land as we're doing the world of cinema this week. Let's talk about Mid-August Lunch, which is, of course, Pranzo di Ferragosto, which is, I suppose you need to know a bit what Ferragosto is, do you?
Oh, I think it's a bank holiday in Italy. It's a bit like as the title suggests, a mid-August bank holiday when everybody quits Rome because it's too hot. But if you've got, say, an old mama to look after, you can't. So you're a bit stuck. And also people want to dump their old mamas on you.
They do. And if you're Gianni Di Gregorio, who is the writer and director of this film, you have to look after all these old ladies.
Ma sei impazzita, sei andata via di casa, mi hai fatto prendere un colpo.
E cosa c'è? Che è successo?
Ma te ne sei andata così?
Certo, sicuro. A me mi piace una serata come questa, io voglio stare fuori casa.
Catherine, so it's set in basically in a flat over a hot Rome, Pranzo di Ferragosto. Did it capture the atmosphere of it? Did it charm you? It's only 75 minutes.
Yeah, I mean, again, I've never actually been in a hot Rome flat with four grannies, but I can imagine it's quite like this. In fact, it didn't really go into the nitty-gritty.
You're a stickler for realism in your cinema, aren't you?
But not true. But I did think it ranked. I completely loved it, actually. And it's amazing that it's the follow-up from the people that did Gomorrah.
Yeah, I mean, Matteo Garrone helped him out. And he this guy, Gianni Di Gregorio, I've never heard of before, he co-wrote a little bit of Gomorrah. There's about five writers on it.
Yeah. I thought it was completely wonderful.
Did you?
I
thought it was really... I thought it was boring, actually. Really? Yeah, all these old people talking about... I know, it was so still short. And I'm not a big fan of old people in the cinema, I have to say.
Why? Because of the smell?
Maybe not old people next to me in the cinema. Oh. That I'm a film critic. I'm afraid I have to put up with that. Most of my colleagues do tend towards that age. I just thought this was really going for a sort of bit of a charming kind of thing, and it failed to charm me. I didn't mind it. I just thought it didn't open up. I didn't see enough of Rome. I really needed to see that twinkly bits of Rome. I really needed to see the area where they were. He just went to his bar once and owed the bloke some kind of money. And I just thought it was a bit claustrophobic in there and smelly.
Isn't that the point, though, that for these oldies, they can't get out? They are a bit stuck. And there was this glorious moment near the end where he gets on a moped with the old tramp bloke and they go and get some fish. And it looked lovely. Yeah, and you thought, well, the old grannies can't do that. That's very sad. Although, actually, four old grannies that you couldn't leave alone, they seemed remarkably good shape.
They were very sprightly and they know how to make a pasta al horno.
Whoa.
I tell you, that lot.
I thought it was a bit too much food porn, actually. I thought it was a little bit sort of...
I just thought, oh God, you've got loads of old grannies in there. Brilliant. What are we going to talk about? Food, of course, because they all know the secret recipes and the ways to man. I just thought it was a little bit cliched as well, and I wanted to see much more else. It didn't get me, I have to say. And I've just been to Italy as well, so I was kind of full of the joys of Ferragosto myself. Well, I didn't like. I mean, he got dumped with these people. He's there because he hasn't got any money, and then the bloke who he owes the money to, who runs the flat that he lives in, says, to pay off your debts and for the elevator and the leaky pipes, you've got to look after my mum. And then he says, oh God, I've got to look after my mum. And then the bloke comes and he says, well, you can look after my aunt as well. And then a doctor comes and looks after him because he's threatened. And he says, well, you can look after my mum as well. And I just thought that whole setup, it didn't have any comedy to it. I thought it should have been a comedy, and it didn't make me laugh once.
Yeah, I think that's true, because actually to laugh about it would seem quite cruel. And he wasn't a sort of uncaring person that hated old people, because he was very kind.
No, absolutely. Well, these women
are
perfectly lovely old women. I mean, actually, they're a bit annoying and cantankerous, actually, to old people, aren't they?
Well, I mean, you'd know more than I would, Jason. But I mean, his own mother was a bit of a pain.
God, wasn't
looked
she?
Looked amazing.
Yeah,
looked
I know. So I mean, absolutely amazing kind of looked. Apparently, she was of the faded aristocracy, according to the press notes. I didn't get that from the film, though.
Well, apparently, one of them was his aunt, and then another was a friend, and then there's two that they just found in care homes.
Yes, and he's made a big thing. In fact, in the press notes, he says, I'll read that. He goes, in the summer of the condominium management, he'd left me, and what I didn't get was actresses. I thought, well, I'll get real people. And I was like, well, you know, just get actresses. They're better than real people.
No.
They are.
No.
See, you love your realism.
Yeah.
This is it. You would like real gang members in your Mexican films.
Oh, yeah.
And real old people are better
cheap
than...
Cheap too.
They are cheaper, that's true. And perhaps they know the secret to pasta al forno, which is probably only in the heart. Shall we move on from Mid-August Lunch, which you like? And I sort of like. I couldn't really be bothered with it, to be honest with you. Ferragosto, I'd rather go away than stay. So we're going to go from Rome to Rochefort, which is in the southwest of France, a port town, which has forever going to be associated with Jacques Demy and Agnès Varda, who arrived there in 1966 to make a film called Les Demoiselles de Rochefort, along with George Takiris, who was in West Side Story, Gene Kelly, who was, of course, the American in Paris, the original guy, with Catherine Deneuve, her sister Françoise de Lauriac, and Michel Legrand doing the music. Let's have a little listen to the two sisters, played by Catherine Deneuve and Françoise de Lauriac. They're playing twins, and this is one of the wonderful songs from Michel Legrand's score to Les Demoiselles de Rochefort. It's called Jumelles.
Delphine, viens voir, ils sont arrivés. Ils s'installent sur la place. Tu sais, les gosses seront jamais prêts. Faudra les faire répéter dimanche matin.
Ben non. Tu crois? Nous sommes deux sœurs jumelles, nées sous le signe des Gémeaux. Mi fa sol la mi ré, ré mi fa sol 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 ré do.
I've been singing that all day. It's terrible. Can't get it out of my head. A very catchy score. I thought a beautiful film myself. I'd never seen Les Demoiselles de Rochefort. I'd seen Les Parapluies de Cherbourg, The Umbrellas of Cherbourg, which he'd done first, and kind of changed the musical because they were all speaking and he put a bit of sadness and romance and sort of realism in the musical. This was a bit more of a homage to Hollywood musicals, it seemed to me.
Yeah, and I sense a theme emerging, to be honest, because I didn't like the fact that this wasn't very realistic. I mean, it seemed highly unrealistic.
And well, fact, nobody seems like that in real life.
And they'd painted the whole town in pastels, hadn't they? And I mean, yeah, it's nice and, you know, oh, you suspend disbelief and you go with it and you think, oh, yeah, it's swinging and they look great and it's a little bit kinky and it's a bit kind of promiscuous and interesting. But it just didn't do it for me, actually.
Really? You couldn't? I mean, it really is a kind of wonderland. I don't think there's much realism in there at all. As you say, they painted the town kind of beautiful pastel shades. The plot as such is kind of, it's sort of negligible, really. There's a troupe have come into the town of Rochefort. They're going to put on a show, but Catherine Deneuve and Francois Deroy, they who run a little dance school, they'd rather be out in Paris kind of hitting the big time and playing at the opera. And then there's a bloke who one of them loves who doesn't know it, and then another one loves it, and then they all sort of meet up in the end. But there is an axe murder that goes on.
I quite like
a
nice
I thought you'd
song.
Like that, a bit of realism.
Well,
there.
That's lovely, yeah. But just I found it a bit wearisome after a while.
Really?
Sorry.
Is it too camp?
It was quite camp. I don't mind a bit of camp, but yeah, maybe it was a bit camp.
It is. I mean, it's pretty camp.
Yeah.
But I found it not an ironic way. It was kind of getting the original in the Susan Sontag way. Definitely camp. I thought it looked amazing. I mean, the song that they do in their big hats, Dloriac and Deneuve, I just thought it was beautifully shot. It looked great. And I loved the dancing. But then I'm a big dance fan. I love watching George Shakira's dance.
Yeah, I didn't watch it at quite the right time of day either. It was sort of very early in the morning. I was a bit tired.
Really? So this would be a shot of adrenaline for me. This would be a double espresso in the morning for me.
You could cope with bright colours in the morning, Jason. I'm not sure I can.
Okay, that's where I live. My road looks like that.
Does it?
Done up, lovely. Ooh. Yeah, we had Jacques Demy in. He did them all.
And you're wearing that hat.
So I have to say that I thought this was absolutely brilliant. I love Michel Legrand in general. And I thought this score was absolutely terrific, very jazzy. There's a lot of West Side Story homage in it, but there's also homage to Vincent Minnelli and Stanley Donen and all that stuff. I do love a musical, it has to be said, which suggests, I mean, I didn't know you were quite so fan of the gritty, Catherine. I didn't know you were such a sort of Nil by Mouth kind of girl.
Yeah.
Yeah, I love Nil by Mouth as well, but the musical version, you should see that. Catherine Shaw, lovely to see you. Always lovely to have you on the show. We don't have you on enough. We only get you on special occasions like Cannes and Bar Mitzvahs and things like that. But it is lovely to see you.
Lovely to be here.
You can read more of Catherine's reviews, opinions and video reviews on the best film news website in the world, guardian.co.uk/film. The actor Isabelle Huppert has in her native France a near iconic status. She's the equivalent perhaps here in the UK of Helen Mirren or Dame Judi Dench, and it's in part due to the intensity of her performances in such films as The Piano Teacher, Heaven's Gate and Madame Bovary, and her work with the finest in French and European directors such as Michael Haneke and Claude Chabrol. Huppert, fresh from her stint as president of the jury at Cannes this year, brings much weight to her latest role as the loving but lost mother Marthe in Ursa Meyer's feature debut, Home.
Oui. Tu veux que je te fasse écouter? Mais si, comme ça t'entendras par toi-même. Attends, bouge pas. T'es toujours là?
Isabelle Huppert there in a scene from Home, in which a blissfully happy family living on the edge of a disused motorway are thrown into disarray as the motorway suddenly opens and the traffic starts to flow. When The Guardian's Andrew Pulver met up with Isabelle Huppert, he started out by asking her what attracted her to the role of the mother in this surreal comedy, Home.
I think I was more attracted by the project in itself than by the role itself, actually. It's a very original film, as you could see. Somewhere between realism and surrealism. And the characters are more archetypes than real psychological characters. So from the very beginning, right away, I could see that the project had a broader ambition than just being a specific story about this woman and this father and these children. It's more having a vision, you know, of the world.
Yeah, I mean, did you immediately sort of cotton onto its metaphoric fable-like element, because it took me a bit of a while to sort of figure out that it wasn't just a sort of straight story.
Yes, yes, it's a fable, as you say. It's an allegory. It's a metaphor about our lives, about the way we live with our families, the way we cope with the outside world, you know. And everything is to be taken on the first degree level, and of course, on a more symbolic level.
Do you recognise? I mean, I'm not going to sort of say that there's anything remotely biographical about the film for yourself, but do you recognise anything of your own experience in the particular, I suppose, the first scenes where it's a more kind of normal family life, if you like?
Well, I think everybody watching the film can, you know, project his own life in this family, because again, it's a universal and eternal family, you know, with all the cliché that goes with it, you know. Mm. Happiness, dependence on one another, promiscuity, sexuality, central and non-central, you know. I mean, all these things are very common to the system of the families in itself, you know. And yes, it's called home, but it becomes hell, because that's, as all that's systems, you know, it's got its own limits.
With Ursula, I mean, did you know her work before you took the film on?
Well, I knew her work before because she'd done a film for television before called The Head and the Shoulders, which was very, very good. But I thought she was an interesting background, you know, because she's... to me, the movie is not 100% French, you know, in its inspiration and spirit. Yeah. And she's not 100% French, you know, she's half French, half Swiss, and she lives in Belgium, and I think the movie is quite Belgium for me, you know.
Do you feel your relationships with certain directors, and particularly obviously Haneke, are you sort of happy going back a second time, and would you go back a third time?
Oh, I certainly would, and I certainly will.
Oh, right. I mean, that's something I did want to ask you about was Cannes and the White Ribbon. So obviously you were president of the jury, and first time, overdue, he won his Palme d'Or. So I'm just interested to know what your thinking was. I mean, I have to say, I saw the White Ribbon very recently. I thought it was absolutely fantastic and totally the right choice. But I'd just be interested to know what your rationale was for picking it as the president.
Well, I thought it was the best film, and apparently the majority, I mean, the nearly majority of the jury members saw the same thing. So there was no discussion about it.
Oh, right. So it was just a sort
of... It was very easy and obvious.
Right. I mean, it just seemed also to me that it was a kind of a less dangerous film than he'd made in the past. I mean, obviously...
it was certainly more universal in a way, and more likable by a large amount of people, even though the subject matter is still very harsh, of course, and very questioning about our world. But yes, it's certainly a simpler film for people to like.
Yeah. And you obviously have a long relationship with Chabrol, as director. Can you perhaps describe some of the differences between working for Haneke and Chabrol? Obviously,
I think that they have the same integrity as artists, and the same approach to just tell the truth, nothing but the truth.
Home is currently on general release here in the UK, and you can see an alternate video version of that interview by going to guardian.co.uk/film. That's all we've got for you on Film Weekly this week. The music featured on the show is from Sin Nombre. It's a wonderful score by Marcelo Zarvos. A big thanks also to you for your kind comments on last week's Vincent Cassel special. Azul Marino posted, great interview, cool guy. Indeed, Vincent Cassel is definitely a cool guy, and I can't wait for the second part of Marine, Public Enemy number 1, coming out in a couple of weeks' time. We'll review that second part here on Film Weekly, of course. Before that, you can join us on Facebook, of course. Film Weekly Fans is our group. Join the swelling number of Film Weekly enthusiasts. There are over 300 of us, so just go there and join up. But for now, from me, Jason Solomons, and my producer, Jason Phipps, it's goodbye.